The last document that I would like us to consider is a scenario that is found in the AMA Virtual Mentor online, which is an ongoing discussion of bioethical issues of interest to the broad American medical profession, and it is available without subscription. So one can simply go to this and look at the various bioethical issues that are raised according to category each month. And I should add that in some previous years and in some previous months, they do raise issues of being aware of the concerns of particular religious groups, particularly the Catholic Church or, say, Jehovah's Witnesses or other groups that have particular concerns in the area of bioethics, although it is intended to be applicable to the broader medical professional community. This scenario and discussion highlights for us, in I think a rather vivid way, the point that we made when looking at advanced directives, and that is that it is always far superior to have a designated proxy in the form of a durable power of attorney or whatever is used in one's state, rather than a simple statement of wishes, because those wishes cannot possibly anticipate in advance all the complexities that arise. And this scenario, I think, raises those issues in a way that is quite believable and in a situation that is not at all uncommon. So if we could just take a look at this text describing Mr. Abbott, who is the hypothetical individual in this scenario. He comes to the local hospital from a nursing home where he's been staying since his dementia became too severe for him to be unsupervised at home. He is 70 years old. His health had been good. It enabled him, while he was before he became ill with pneumonia, to enjoy the nursing facility. He was able to stroll on the grounds, participated in art and music therapy, visited with family and pets on a weekly basis, but he's now been admitted to the hospital with a diagnosis of pneumonia. He's in respiratory distress, having difficulty breathing, and it's likely that he's going to have to be intubated. Well, years before his dementia became severe, he had documented in an advance directive that if he ever became demented and was unable to recognize family or friends, he would prefer that no attempt be made to resuscitate him should it ever be necessary. Note a couple of things here. Number one, this is someone who is not yet demented making a judgment about the level of incapacity that they think they will experience if they're no longer able to recognize family and friends. Number one. Number two, there is no definition of what resuscitation means. In this case, we're facing the possibility of intubation, but not necessarily a lifetime of intubation. It's possible that he could be intubated on a ventilator for a while, treated with antibiotics, and might return to his state of health. He might not. But his medical condition is such that one might seriously question whether it's what he had in mind when he filled out his advance directive. Well, his family, which includes three children, never attempted to hide the directive, which was in the medical record, but they are now insisting that it should not be acted upon, despite the fact that he made a very clear statement that he did not wish to be resuscitated, and one can only presume that he's reached the state where he's not able to properly recognize family and friends. Otherwise, the question wouldn't have arisen. And so effectively, the family is saying that they want him to be intubated despite his advance directive. Now, in neither of the two commentaries that follow, one by a medical student and the other by a physician, in neither case do the commentators believe that the advance directive should be allowed to stand. And so what we have are discussions that remind us of the limitations of what I've described as living wills, as attempts to anticipate in advance all of one's circumstances. And again, the bottom line will be, don't try to write it all out. Find someone you trust who can speak for you and designate that person. If that had been done here, there would be no scenario. There would be no case. But there are some very useful points that are raised by these two commentators. First by Mr. Lawrence. who points out that there has been a hierarchy of decision making, which is generally widely accepted, at least in the United States, a hierarchy of principles that one applies. First of all, one considers any directives the patient may have articulated when they were competent. This is all in the absence of a decision maker. Second is substituted judgment. What do we think the individual themselves would actually want if they could be asked? And if you can't do either number one or number two, you act in what you believe to be the patient's best interests. So this hierarchy of values has generally tended to be respected, but it doesn't really deal with the situation at hand, because the desire here on the part of pretty much everybody involved is to set aside the person's clearly stated wishes in his original advance directive. So, what about advance directives? Number 1.1, as the commentator points out, there is no specification of what forms of resuscitation one wouldn't want. There are a variety of forms of resuscitation. Giving IVs is one form. Chest compressions are not benign. Intubation, it depends on whether or not it's likely to have to become chronic or permanent. Certainly, if a person is experiencing air hunger, they may greatly desire and be delighted at intubation, which takes away the sensation of suffocation. So DNR doesn't have a very specific meaning. It has to be very specifically designated, and it needs to be adapted to the circumstances of the individual themselves. This commentator points out that Alzheimer's dementia goes on gradually. Some days are better than others. So which day's decisions do you take more seriously, when the patient's having a bad day or when he's having a good day? Makes it very difficult to interpret a document. And also, he points out, the commentator points out, and it's been highlighted in white, patients often have misunderstandings about the interventions that they are choosing or rejecting. They need to have these explained to them, and the implications of treatment need to be explained as well. It's not just a question of anticipating in advance all the things that might happen. And indeed, patients quite rightly fear procedures that will only prolong the experience of dying, or will render their existence more painful and miserable. But what if that's not the case? How do you grapple with the complexities? Well, again, it has to be done by someone whose judgment you trust. And in number 1.2, the commentator suggests that the patient did not know that his existence, despite Alzheimer's disease, might in fact be a happy one. Or at least he appears to enjoy his life, appears to enjoy eating and interacting with people. That's a hard thing for a person to anticipate in advance of the actual experience of that kind of slow deterioration. He points out, and this is highlighted in yellow, that one does need to be aware of the fact that sometimes family members' decisions to override an advance directive may actually be their own preferences being substituted under the guise of doing what the individual would want. Well, number 1.3, dropping down, what is in the patient's best interests? In general, it's the patient's best interests to respect their autonomy, but what if in their autonomy they didn't actually anticipate the circumstances properly? And the commentator points out, and this text is highlighted in yellow, that the odds for the patient surviving are really not bad in this particular clinical setting. So, number 1.4, leaving the principles aside, the commentator points out, if the person can't make their own decisions, someone else is going to have to do it for them. So the question is, who is going to be the surrogate decision maker here? And this commentator concludes that refusing to implement this advance directive doesn't necessarily mean that we are failing to respect the patient. If indeed the statements contained in the advance directive are probably not applicable to this particular situation, that the individual might well have changed their mind if this scenario had been suggested to them. And so this first commentator concludes that the family should be allowed to make the final verdict. And the physician should not forbid intubation despite the patient's advanced directives. There are a number of references listed. So if we drop down to commentary number two, by Dr. Browner. Here we have a, he says, a very, he comments on the previous commentary, pointing out that it is important to recognize that in some cases advanced directives do not anticipate what one would want to do. And he emphasizes here another bioethicist, Stephen Post, who questions whether we honor the wishes of the then earlier autonomous person or the present individual who has been transformed by their mental disability, by their ongoing dementia. There was the then person and the now person. Is it only the then person that has the right to be involved in decision making? And he quite rightly questions, well, what has been done to involve this individual in decision-making. If we drop down to number 2.1, he too points out that the meaning of resuscitation here is not clear. And although we now ask everyone who is in this situation, or we regard it as appropriate to, with the reservations we've noted in regard to Dr. Blackhall's research, that everybody is supposed to be invited to reflect on and anticipate what kind of end of care they might wish to receive. But here again, the difficulty is that the significance of that care might only be obvious at the time when the issue of its application arises. And he goes over the history of CPR, which we've also discussed earlier in the course. He talks in number 2.2, if we drop down, to the legacy of cardiac arrest and DNR, and points out what is important to highlight, and that is that the term DNR needs to be explained. It doesn't necessarily mean no use of any modalities. One needs to choose the things that are appropriate for the individual. But he does point out, and rather skeptically but honestly, that the great irony of our legacy is that the CPR procedure, which stimulates all of this discourse, will most likely not be effective in significantly altering the outcome of the illness or process from which most of us will die. He's pointing out that if you look at the actuarial statistics in regard to the things of which most people die, and look at how they what things are like towards the end of life, the likelihood of CPR being actually beneficial is rather small. So one's talking about the use of something which, in fact, in the majority of cases, is probably not going to be very helpful. And he describes it as a ritualized discussion that compels physicians to offer a therapy which will most likely be ineffective. An issue that we will again consider when we look a little later at the course, in the course at more specifically at end-of-life issues and of the kind of care one is morally obliged or permitted to refuse at the end of life. And this physician commentator then agrees that the advance directive should not be interpreted literally, but that, and this is highlighted in red, a time-limited trial of intubation with aggressive antibiotic treatment for pneumonia is often a quite palatable choice for older patients who share the understandable dread of spending the last days of their life in a prolonged death or on a ventilator. And so here we've got a very clear discussion which highlights for us again the significance of the fact that when we are considering informed consent in the context of advanced directives, it is vitally important to emphasize that advanced directives should focus on the designation of a proxy and not on an attempt to state preferences in a way that will be extremely difficult to interpret when the actual event arises. Find a living, breathing human being. Do not write a complex document that will be impossible for theologians or physicians to interpret.